From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
A Caribbean coalition government is on the verge of collapse. Maurice Bishop's mother says she cannot forgive. And why Cuban refugees are treated better than Haitians in Miami. I'm Jessica Robertson, and you're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. The government of the Netherlands Antilles was on the verge of collapsing this afternoon due to rifts within the six-party coalition over austerity measures. The gravity of the situation was underlined today when Prime Minister Susie Carmelia Roima said she cannot continue to work without the support of her coalition partners. Mike Jarvis has the latest.
Over the past few days, bickering between the three Curaçao parties in the six-party coalition has intensified over differences on cost-cutting measures, mainly reducing the civil service. The Christian Democrat People's National Party of Prime Minister Susie Carmelia Roima, the Popular Labour Party of President of Parliament and Labour leader Errol Cover, and the smaller Frente Obrero Liberacion Party, which has a strong working-class following, have been unable to come to agreement on the cost-cutting element of the austerity package. Just recently, the Parliament of the Netherlands Antilles approved a series of revenue-raising measures. In addition to the frictions at the federal level, it is similar discontent at the level of the local government of Curaçao which has led to the present crisis. That government is also coalition, but between only the PNP and the Labour Party. The crisis stems out of conditions set by the commercial banks in Curaçao, to whom the local government had turned for a loan to pay salaries until the end of the year. The banks are demanding that the government cuts costs, beginning with the civil service. Both the federal and local governments have been criticized for delaying the cost-cutting measures. But while the PNP now admits there is no alternative but to implement those measures, and quickly, the Labour Party and the Frente Obrero want the matter to be studied further. The Labour Party had earlier written a very critical letter to the PNP, accusing it of making statements and taking decisions without adequate consultation with its coalition partners. If the federal government does fall, it will have a domino effect on the local government of Curaçao. Behind-the-scenes maneuverings were in high gear Friday afternoon, given the double-barreled effect of a split among the coalition partners in Curaçao. For BBC Caribbean Report, this is Mike Jarvis in Dutch St. Martin.
The leaders of the 1983 revolution, which led to the assassination of Prime Minister Maurice Bishop, may have apologized from their prison cells. But while some Grenadians believe they deserve a second chance, an overwhelming majority says sorry, but they cannot forgive. One of those finding it hard to accept the apology is the former Prime Minister's 84-year-old mother, Alimentha Bishop.
What comes to my mind is, it is just a whole hypocrisy, I should say. Because after all these years, I don't know. I'm so grieved every time this month comes around. And so many questions, it just raised a new sorrow, new something in my mind, and have me so upset. As I say to people say I can laugh and I'm looking happy. I say, but although I'm smiling, it's affecting the heart. I'm crying on the inside. I would not feel happy unless they are able to give me or show me the remains of my son to give him a burial after all those so many years.
That was Alimentha Bishop, the mother of slain Grenadian Prime Minister Maurice Bishop.
Very happy because this is a victory for human rights, it's a victory for people everywhere. It's a bad news for dictator, for General Pinochet and all dictators like him. And never again they can go around killing people and laughing around, you know, and go away and enjoy impunity.
Chilean protesters are celebrating the decision by a magistrate who ruled that former dictator Augusto Pinochet could be extradited to Spain. It's the latest stage in a long and expensive legal battle. In an unprecedented move, Pinochet was arrested while on holiday in London last year. It followed a request by a Spanish judge who had been seeking to charge the former Chilean leader during his rule. The outcome of this case could have repercussions for other despots, dictators, and leaders. Earlier today, I spoke to Nick Kaester, BBC's Latin America analyst, and asked him how relevant this case is to the Caribbean.
I think the most important thing for the Caribbean and other parts of the world is the fact that they, a long time ago already, they didn't recognize General Pinochet as having immunity from prosecution, which of course applies to anyone in the Caribbean islands or wherever who is suspected of human rights abuses and has gone abroad and thinks they're in a safe haven. If ever those people like Cedras from Haiti or Baby Doc Duvalier or whoever comes to Britain and someone wants to extradite them, it's fairly clear from all the rulings over the past year in the Pinochet case that the British justice will take that seriously.
Is that likely to happen?
I think, fortunately or unfortunately, that this Pinochet case has served as a test case for all the people who are wanted internationally and people from the Caribbean, from Latin America, or even from Eastern Europe, from Kosovo, from Bosnia, will realize that they can't come to Britain to do their Christmas shopping or whatever, as General Pinochet tended to do, that they run a serious risk of meeting this new resistance, really, of the international community to accepting them in their midst. And this case has happened in Britain, but France has shown its willingness to adopt a similar disposition with regard to Duvalier, for example, and I don't think the United States can be far behind with other people from the Caribbean or other people from around the world.
So is it likely to have an effect on current dictators and leaders?
I think that's going a bit far. I don't think people are going to moderate their behavior because of a possible consequence many years down the line. So I think that there is a willingness throughout the world to say that what people do in their own country cannot be just kept to that country, but it's got international repercussions. And I suppose that it will make some people think twice.
BBC's Latin America expert, Nick Kaester. You're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. The United States' immigration policies have once again come under scrutiny. It follows the recent surge of Cubans and Haitians to Florida shores during a break in the hurricane season. Advocates say when it comes to deciding who gets to stay, the Cuban or the Haitian refugee, more often than not, it's the Cuban. Keystone Graves has been trying to find out why this is so.
According to immigration experts and advocates, the number of Cubans turning up on the shores of Florida is increasing. And they say that one of the common occurrences is for the Cubans to leap into the sea and swim furiously for shore, then stand on the beach and await capture. It's different if you're Haitian. Advocates say that Haitians who manage to reach shore quickly vanish into the urban areas. New York-based attorney Arthur Helton is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He specializes in immigration issues. He said from the time of the Cold War, there has been a difference in the privilege and discrimination in the treatment of Cuban and Haitian asylum seekers.
On the high seas, Cubans are screened to see if they may have a well-founded fear of persecution before they are returned to Cuba, having been intercepted by the U.S. Coast Guard or others. And in Cuba, they have an opportunity to participate in a special migration program between the United States and Cuba, which was established this decade. For Haitians, if they make it to the shore, they are treated in no special way. Oftentimes, they end up in detention. On the high seas, Haitians are intercepted and swiftly returned to Haiti.
The experts say that while the United States has softened its policy somewhat in recent years, Cubans have been favored for decades, especially under the U.S. immigration policy known as wet feet, dry feet. Since they've been officially viewed as refugees from a communist government, almost all Cubans who reach U.S. territory have received automatic permanent residency. In 1966, the U.S. Congress passed the Cuban Adjustment Act, which said that any Cuban who has been admitted or prorogued into the U.S. can apply for lawful permanent residence after a year and a day. This is not open to any other nationality. Joan Freeland, a lawyer with the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, thinks it's an enormous advantage for the Cubans, but for Haitians, skin color could be a factor.
The law was passed in 1966. Most of the Cubans who were arriving then were white and well-to-do or professionals. So you can draw your own conclusions from that.
And as more and more Cubans and Haitians attempt to move further north, immigration experts and advocates don't think the difference in treatment will go away anytime soon.
That report from Keystone Graves. Trinidad and Tobago's Finance Minister Brian Kwaitung today unveiled his government's $2.2 billion budget, which will take the country into the year 2000. The government hopes to create 15,000 new jobs in the coming year, with a $300 million capital investment plan. The finance minister said that unemployment in Trinidad and Tobago hit a 15-year low in June, with just 11% of the population out of work. The budget debate starts next week Friday, and the new fiscal year begins at the end of this month. For many, it may have been a disaster causing death, a mass exodus, and years of inconvenience. But for scientists, Montserrat's active volcano has provided a rare chance to study just how volcanoes work. This week, volcano experts from across the world met at Britain's Royal Society to hear the details of the studies being conducted in Montserrat. Debbie Ransom takes a look at their findings and plans for the future.
The meeting included scientists who have been studying the volcano over the last 4 years and other experts from around the world conducting research on other volcanoes. They've been discussing the scientific findings as well as the examples of how to simply manage a volcanic crisis. Dr. Simon Young is the current director of Montserrat's Volcano Observatory. He says Soufrière Hills has provided unprecedented access to an active volcano.
One of the good things about Montserrat was that we were able to get very good scientific instruments on the volcano at a fairly early stage, and that's quite unusual in a volcanic crisis. Quite often you try and just get fairly simple instrumentation in place to do the basic job. On Montserrat, because it was a long-lived eruption, we were able to develop the scientific aspects so that we were getting really good information about scientific information. And so that's really given us an extra step along the path towards learning about it. And so there are very many aspects about how a dome grows, how the magma gets from a magma chamber at 6 or 7 kilometres down in the under the volcano up to the surface, the changes that it goes through in the process, and what that how that affects the surface manifestations that we see and that impact on people. And so, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons about how that happens and about how the seismicity, the earthquakes related to that process, the swelling or contraction of the volcano, the gases that come out of the volcano, how all of those things that we're monitoring feed into the final analysis of how the volcano is hazardous and what might happen. And so there are many, many aspects. And as I said, the very good information we got from Montserrat helped us take us forward in many areas.
Montserrat is being held up as something of a model. With only 19 deaths despite the active nature of the volcanic activity and the remaining population living on the north of the island in relative security, the world is being told that this is the way to handle a natural disaster. And now that Soufrière Hills has surrendered many of its secrets, scientists are now turning their attention to the underwater volcano Kikamjeni. With its potential to throw possible tidal waves on the coastlines of Grenada and surrounding islands, this volcano is coming under increased scrutiny. Simon Young again.
There certainly would be some interest in certain aspects of what we're doing. There are ongoing research projects on Kikamjeni. The seismic research unit in Trinidad is doing work there, and they have seismometers which measure earthquakes around Kikamjeni. And I know that one of the universities in the northeastern Caribbean, the University of the Virgin Islands, is also involved in doing surveys of Kikamjeni and looking at it. So there is regional awareness of Kikamjeni and work going on, and certainly the people who are at the meeting that I'm attending this week are interested in certain aspects of it, those aspects which do relate to Montserrat and a similar kind of eruption.
The scientists are hoping that now that Soufrière Hills has less ash and dust to throw out, it can help throw up some secrets which will help them to handle future volcanic activity, either above ground or underwater.
That was Debbie Ransom reporting. Before we go, just a look at our lead story. The government of the Netherlands Antilles is on the verge of collapsing, this due to rifts within the six-party coalition over austerity measures. The gravity of the situation was underlined earlier today when Prime Minister Susie Carmelia Roima said she cannot continue to work without the support of her coalition partners. And that's it for BBC Caribbean Report. Just a reminder that
this and our other programs can be accessed on our internet website at www.bbc.co.uk/Caribbean.
Join us at 11.05, 11.15 and 12.10 GMT for our next morning programs. I'm Jessica Robertson saying goodbye from London.